Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Anna Mateo, Jill Robbins, and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present the first part in our series on America's presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Memorial Day is a national holiday observed in the United States on the last Monday in May. This year, Memorial Day is observed on May 31st. It is the day when Americans honor the women and men who have died fighting in America's wars. For most Americans, however, it is the unofficial start of summer. Carol Everhart is president of the Rehoboth Beach-Dewey Beach Chamber of Commerce. The organization often refers to the towns in Delaware as the nation's summer capital, since people from Washington, D.C. will likely spend the summer along their beaches. Everhart said, "We expect very, very high visits this summer." She pointed out that some could not wait to start their summer vacation after the year-long pandemic. People, she said, have visited the Delaware coasts as early as January, shortly after the start of the COVID-19 vaccination program. In 2019, the Delaware beaches had nearly 8 million summer visitors. With vaccination and without cloth face coverings or social distancing, Everhart said she expects to have as many as 9 million visitors this year.
Back in the nation's capital of Washington, D.C., Memorial Day tradition continues with the observance at Arlington National Cemetery across the Potomac River. It is the most famous burial place in America. Before the pandemic, more than 4 million people visited the cemetery every year. The tradition began on May 30, 1868. When flowers were placed on the graves of Union and Confederate soldiers in the cemetery. It was called Decoration Day back then. Since 1948, on the Thursday before Memorial Day, soldiers from the 3rd U.S. Infantry, the Old Guard, have placed small American flags in front of every headstone in the cemetery. Lines of simple white headstones mark the soldiers' graves. But the 80-hectare cemetery also serves as a burial place for people of national and historical importance. Two presidents are buried there. William Howard Taft in 1930, and John F. Kennedy in 1963. Other famous people buried at the cemetery include world champion boxer Joe Louis, North Pole explorer Robert E. Peary, and the 7 astronauts who died in the Space Shuttle Challenger explosion. Nearly 4,000 former slaves are also buried at Arlington. One of them is James Parks. He dug the first graves in the cemetery.
The best-known memorial in the nation's capital, however, is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which opened in 1982. In 1980, a group of former soldiers announced a competition to design a memorial. The winner was Maya Lin, a 21-year-old student at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Lin designed a memorial formed by two walls of black stone, about 76 meters long. The walls meet to form a V. The names of more than 58,000 Americans killed or declared missing in action are cut into the stone. Almost any time of day, you can see people looking for the name of a family member or friend who died in the war. Once they find the name, many rub a pencil on paper over the letters to copy it. Many people leave remembrances at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. After the success of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, Congress approved a memorial to the Korean War veterans, which opened in July of 1995. The Korean War lasted from 1950 to 1953. The memorial honors those who died. It also honors those who survived. The Korean War has been called the last foot soldiers' war. The memorial includes a group of 19 statues of soldiers. People who drive along a road near the memorial sometimes think the statues are real soldiers. The Women in Military Service for America Memorial opened in 1997. The memorial is near the entrance of Arlington National Cemetery. It recognizes the service of all the women who have taken part in the nation's wars. About 2 million women have served or currently serve in the armed forces.
One of the lesser-known memorials on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., is often called the Temple. The round stone structure honors people from the District of Columbia who died in World War I. The war was fought from 1914 to 1918. The memorial was completed in 1931. It is the only District of Columbia memorial on the National Mall. Between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument on the National Mall is the World War II Memorial. The United States entered the war after Japan bombed the Navy base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, on December 7, 1941. 16 million men and women served in the American military between 1941 and 1945. More than 400,000 died. The World War II Memorial is built of bronze and granite. In the center, at ground level, is a round pool of water. Except in very cold weather, water shoots from a circle of fountains in the middle. When the sun is just right, rainbows of color dance in the air. 56 stone pillars rise around the pool. They represent each of the American states and territories, plus the District of Columbia, at the time of the war. On two tall arches appear the names of where the fighting took place. One says Atlantic, the other says Pacific. There are not yet memorials for soldiers who died in America's most recent wars, in Iraq and Afghanistan. The soldiers are buried in Section 60 of Arlington Cemetery. The section is often called the saddest place in America. On Memorial Day, Americans will stop for 1 minute at 3 o'clock local time for the National Moment of Remembrance to honor the soldiers who have died in service to the country, no matter what wars they served in. I'm Ana Mateo.
And I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
The United States government is facing new pressure to solve a mystery. Are American diplomats and officials being attacked with microwaves or radio waves? The attack has been called the Havana Syndrome because the first cases affected officials in 2016 at the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. People who are believed to be affected have reported pain in the head, losing balance, and signs related to concussions. Others have reported hearing a loud noise before experiencing the syndrome. A U.S. defense official said there are at least 130 cases across the government now under an investigation. Especially worrying are the discoveries of at least two possible incidents around Washington, D.C. One happened near the White House last November. As the number of cases grows, U.S. lawmakers and the people who may have been affected want answers. But scientists and government officials do not know who might be responsible, or even if the incidents were actually attacks. An official review by the U.S. government could have far-reaching impacts. If a U.S. enemy has been carrying out damaging attacks against U.S. officials, there would be calls for a serious countermeasure. For now, the Biden administration says it takes the problem seriously and is making sure those affected have good medical care. Mark Zaid is a lawyer representing several people who have experienced the syndromes. He and other critics say the U.S. government has not taken the problem seriously or provided those impacted with necessary medical support. Zaid received National Security Agency documents with information about attacks dating to the 1990s. The documents note an unknown hostile country, possibly having a microwave weapon, to weaken, intimidate, or kill an enemy over time. The government has a much better understanding of it than it has let on, Zaid said. William Burns is the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He told Congress that he would make sure the investigation gets to the bottom of what caused these incidents and who was responsible. So far, U.S. officials have not identified a possible country. A study looking at causes of the attacks was published last December by the National Academy of Sciences. The study identifies directed pulsed radio frequency energy as the most probable cause. It says a radio frequency attack could change brain activity without causing severe structural damage. But the study could not make a certain judgment on how U.S. officials may have been hit. James Giordano is a neurology professor at Georgetown University. He has worked with the State Department on investigating the Havana cases. Giordano said there is evidence of brain injuries in several people, suggesting they may have been affected by radio waves. He identified two possible sources. One is a device used to directly target people. Another is a tool that used energy waves for intelligence gathering. that tool may have accidentally harmed the targeted people. I'm Jill Robbins.
Scientists say that for the first time, a new genetic treatment has helped a blind patient partly regain his sight. The treatment is a form of optogenetics, a method that genetically changes cells to make them produce light-sensitive proteins. While the method had long been used in studies of the brain, research related to treating blind patients had not been done. In the new experiments, a blind patient was able to use special eyeglasses to identify and count different objects sitting on a table. A team of researchers from the United States and Europe recently reported the findings in a study appearing in Nature Medicine. One of the patients in the study was a 58-year-old man who has suffered with retinitis pigmentosa for 40 years. The progressive eye disease destroys light-sensing cells in the eye's retina and can lead to total blindness. These light-sensing cells, called photoreceptors, communicate visual information to the brain through the optic nerve. But when these cells progressively fail, blindness sets in. The experiments used genetic methods to add a light-sensing protein to the retina's cells. The kind of protein used, called Crimson R, can be found in algae, the researchers said. The protein reacts to light by changing its shape and permitting the flow of ions into cells. The patient's worst-seeing eye was injected with a vector or carrier that contained genetic instructions for the Crimson R protein. The protein is only sensitive to amber-colored light, which the researchers said they used because it is safer than blue-colored light and causes less strain on the eye. For the experiment, the team built a special set of glasses or goggles that contained a camera to capture and project visual images onto the retina at amber light wavelengths. The patient began training with the goggles about 5 months after the injection to give the protein enough time to settle in the cells. After learning to use the goggles, the patient was able to recognize, count, find, and touch different objects sitting on a table in front of him. In addition, the patient also reported improvements in his ability to identify other objects during his day-to-day activities in both indoor and outdoor environments, the researchers said. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about George Washington. He was the first president of the United States. He served from 1789 to 1797. But he had many other accomplishments, too. He owned thousands of hectares of land in his home state of Virginia. He was a famous general, who led the American colonists to freedom from British rule, and he presided over the convention that created the U.S. Constitution. For Washington, that was enough. He said he wanted to retire from public service and return home. But the country's new electors had other ideas. They wanted him to move to New York and invent the American presidency. Washington accepted the job as his duty. Washington was sworn in as president in 1789. At the time, a truly United States was still just an idea. Americans were unconnected groups. They came from different countries, had different religions, and spoke different languages. For example, a quarter of the people in the state of Pennsylvania spoke only German. Doug Bradburn is the founding director of the Washington Library at Mount Vernon. He says, when Washington took office, the country was fragile.
The chances that it would even survive were probably very, very slim.
Bradburn explains that Washington had to establish social and political unity. But the Constitution did not say how the president could do that. So, Bradburn says, Washington invented the job for all future presidents. He established a group of advisors called the Cabinet, as well as the nation's official money. He appointed a 6-member Supreme Court, and he created the Department of Foreign Affairs, now called the State Department. However, Washington said it was the president's responsibility to set foreign policy. Historian Doug Bradburn explains that Washington established the president not just as a figurehead, but as a decision maker. But he always used the Constitution as his guide.
He wasn't just trying to establish an office and then figure out a way to justify it. He was trying to work with his Constitution.
George Washington was born in 1732 in the colony of Virginia. His father died when George was 11 years old. As a boy, he learned reading, writing, and math. Then he worked as a land surveyor in western Virginia. Historian Joseph Ellis points out that Washington did not have a formal education. Instead of going to college, Ellis says, Washington went to war. He fought against the French and Indians as a British army officer. That experience informed Washington's worldview. Ellis describes the first president as a realist. At the same time, Washington was a very passionate man with extremely strong emotions. He was known to get angry, but he showed his temper to only a few people. Washington not only acted like a great leader, he looked like one. George Washington stood about 1.9 meters tall. That was a head taller than the average man of his time. He was very strong and very graceful. He was known as one of the best horseback riders and best dancers in Virginia. But he had a problem: bad teeth. Unlike his wife, Martha, who was known for her lovely smile, George Washington began losing his teeth in his 20s. When he was sworn in as president, he had only one tooth left. Washington remains an important figure in the American imagination. Even today, people tell stories about him. One popular story, that he had wooden teeth, is not true. But he did wear dentures. They were made, in part, from hippopotamus ivory. And he did not chop down a cherry tree as a child, and then admit it by saying, "I cannot tell a lie." In fact, historian Joseph Ellis says, Washington lied many times. But it is true that as Washington became more famous, his reputation grew. People thought of him as a man who always did the right thing. Joseph Ellis says even Washington understood people would look at his writings and judge him.
Washington went from being a man to a monument. He was aware of the fact that he had a role to play and that all emerging nations need mythical heroes.
Washington became very protective of his personal thoughts. His wife burned most of their letters. Yet, we know a little bit about Washington's thoughts from other writing. One of his regrets, he said, was that he had not done something to end slavery. Like many plantation owners, Washington was a slaveholder. More than 300 enslaved people lived on his property. By the end of his life, Washington opposed slavery. He left a will ordering his survivors to free his slaves after his wife's death. Washington's will became relevant sooner than he might have liked. 3 years after he finished his second term as president, Washington fell ill. He had been outside riding his horse on a cold, wet day. When he came home, he complained of a sore throat. Over the next 2 days, his condition became worse. On December 14th, 1799, he died in his bed, surrounded by his wife, enslaved maids, and friends. He was 67. Historian Joseph Ellis says one of the best things about George Washington was his ability to give up power. At the end of the Revolutionary War, General Washington surrendered his sword. And at the end of his administration, President Washington simply returned home.
You could trust Washington with power because he was so conspicuously willing to give it up.
Doug Bradburn says Washington was the right man at the right time. Bradburn, like many historians, calls George Washington the indispensable man. In other words, Washington was essential to the American experiment in self-government. He made ideas about American freedom real, and he showed that even the president would operate under the rule of law. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.